The basics of soil. What is soil? This deceptively simple question needs some exploration before going forward because it's not just about dirt. One of the most common mistakes, and guilty as charged, is to use the word soil to really talk about the defining bedrock. But they are completely different. Soil, and this is topsoil, is the covering that cushions the earth's hard rock, which is bedrock. Its origins can be from the sea or from volcanoes, from plants, trees, leaves, rocks, animals, and microorganisms. Over the eons, organic and mineral matter erodes and decays. That soil is home to fungi, bacteria, worms, and other critters. It is where they conspire to extract the minerals needed for life. They deliver them to the roots of the plant. The plant develops, it finds its way to our table and nourishes and feeds us. That is, if that soil is alive and not destroyed by intensive agriculture. Topsoils manifest in a range of textures, including sand, gravel, and clay, and consist of multiple layers. The top is the organic matter humus, the rich nutrient layer that can be deep, shallow, or non-existent. Just below that is the mineral subsoil, made of eroded rocky bits from the bedrock and decomposed organic matter. This is also called the clay humus complex, and that's where the magic happens, between the roots and the soil. It is where the plant takes in necessary nutrients, such as nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, iron, and boron, for its metabolism. Underneath that is the parent material, which can be the rock that defines the region, though, and this is important, it is rare that one region is ever 100% one rock type, such as schist or granite. Underneath that layer is the almost impenetrable bedrock that in a few thousand years will become soil. It is essential to the vine, to the plant, and to humans that the soil remains vibrant, full of activity and life, as it is the basis for everything that happens next. Soil has often been called the planet's skin, but when I heard someone say that the soil is the planet's gut, it seemed even more profound. You'd have to live under a rock not to have heard about the importance of gut bacteria. Just as we have healthy bacteria that live in our intestines, healthy soils, such as the ones from the winemakers in this book, have up to a staggering 100 million to 1 billion molecules of bacteria in one little teaspoon. That's a lot of life. What does that mean to the vine? Soil scientist Patrick Holden sees it like this. Those microbes play a central role in breaking down organic matter into absorbable nutrients, which are then available to plants through their root systems. Another noted microbiologist, the soil guru Elaine Ingham, remains dismayed by the many lingering mysteries. We know more about the stars in the sky than about the soil under our feet. While some people need scientific proof, others go with their gut. But sometimes, all you need is a visual. Take a walk into a champagne vineyard, as I did with a friend in 2003. It was a long time ago, but vineyards in the region for the big companies haven't changed much. We stood in the vines of Pierre Larmandier. The soil was spongy and bursting with life. Just next door were vines belonging to Veuve Clicquot. The Clicquot soils were compact, unyielding, and barren. The juxtaposition of dead and living was enough to change my friend's relationship to her table and drink choices. On an emotional level, she understood the difference and from then on could taste it in the glass. She wasn't going to drink industrial champagne ever again. Topsoils and textures. Often, it is the texture of the topsoil, clay, sand, gravel, silt, less, or loam, that defines a region. Clay. When we talk about clay, we think of the dry stuff that gets slippery when wet. But if you dig down into the molecular particulars, clay minerals form in sheets. This structure has a huge impact on the way the clay functions. Some say there are certain clays that are better for pottery than vines, but that's hotly contested. It depends on where you are, what your climate is, what kind of wines you want to make, blousy or elegant, and what clay minerals are in the mix. And when you get a certain amount of the right stuff, like in Burgundy, where the clay is mixed with limestone, it can be just what the climate ordered. The important aspect about clay is its plasticity and its ability to expand and contract with water and hold on to those minerals, saving them for the plant's digestion. When clay dries, it shrinks and hardens on the surface, but deep down, the clay subsoil holds on to the moisture in its tight little fist, generously doling it out to the thirsty soils during drought conditions. Can you taste clay's effect? Well, some sure can. Look for a richness in the middle palate, sometimes a rustiness, and sometimes a deep cherry that you know does not come from the vine. The taste can feel blocky in the mouth. The terroirologist Pedro Parra says that these wines are more generous and rounder, providing the exception, because in this soil you do feel fruit. Some examples of areas that really stick to your Blundstone boots and show the wine in your mouth: Abruzzo in Italy, Amerti in Georgia, Emilia-Romagna in Italy. Sand. Whether it's a beach carpeted with white silica or a shore spread with black grains of basaltic glass, sand is a texture, not a rock. It can be made from anything that is pulverized. Unlike clay, sandy soils drain easily, like a sieve. This is a boon in a monsoon-like season, but in a drought? Pity those poor vines, unless they happen to be planted in an especially humid climate. Still, most old vines still standing on their own roots are on those sandy patches of vinelands throughout the world. Can you taste the sand's effect? In 1825, influential wine aficionado James Busby wrote that the sandy soil will, in general, produce a delicate wine. But it could also produce a simple one, especially if on very beachy sands of silica, and often gives a direct translation of fruit flavor that makes for uncomplicated but fun presentations, as if there is nothing in between the grape and the taste. Some great examples are from the sedimentary Californian Evangelo vineyard outside of Sacramento. Look for labels like Bedrock, Dirty and Rowdy, Sandlands, and Dash, or the Colares region in Portugal. On volcanic sand, this would be Mount Etna in Sicily and Lanzarote in the Canary Islands. Gravel. These rocks, ranging from pebbles to cobbles, are mostly associated with sediment and limestone. The rocks easily absorb the heat and, as a result, contribute to making more alcoholic wines, which, depending on where this is, could be a bane or boon. Lesser known are the gimblet gravels of New Zealand and Walla Walla in Washington. Some extremely famous regions are Châteauneuf-du-Pape and the Médoc and Grave sections of Bordeaux. The most exalted gravel soils in the world come from Bordeaux. This region has a curious history which reaches back to the 17th century when the Dutch drained the swamps on what was then unusable land. In doing so, they exposed alluvial beds and plenty of gravel. Gravel, whether pebble-sized or boulder-sized, was extremely beneficial in getting the hard-to-ripen vines of Bordeaux to give tasty fruit. Why? Sure, gravel gives great drainage, important in the often wet Grave region, but primarily, when the gravel is light in color, it is about warming the earth, about reflecting the sun and holding on to the heat. Whether limestone or basalt, texture and size trumps the mineral component of the gravel. Often the land is so difficult to farm it's not suitable for anything else but vine. Silt. Sometimes called stone dust, silt is finer, more fertile, and has better water retention than sand. But in farming, one has to be careful as the soil is prone to compaction. Not exactly the best soils for grapes, but great for clogging up your water pipes. Less. Caught between silt and loam, less is made up of chiefly wind-blown sediments, mostly silica. You find it referred to widely in Austria, where they rarely grow their Riesling on it. In Walla Walla, Washington, it is quite deep, like a layer of sawdust, and very well drained. Loam. While not literally a texture, it is a combination of textural elements. Fertile, and sometimes too fertile, loam is a pretty even mixture of sediments, sand, silt, and clay. This combo is at home in much of California where, compounded by the state's fertile soils, one has to expect a great deal of fruitiness. If you consider that the best wines are said to come from poor soils of low fertility, well, draw your own conclusions. That said, one can make smarter farming choices based on climate. What could work? Increase competition in the vineyard by growing the right vegetables between the rows and adjusting the trellising of the vine, so all does not have to be lost. What makes a great vineyard site and the conundrum of terroir? I was standing with Aubert de Valin, the managing director of the iconic winery Domaine de la Romanée Conti, DRC. We were in his parcel of La Tache, a Grand Cru in the village of Vosne-Romanée. As we stared at the soil, he mused about the veracity of the superiority of certain spots. Do you need science to prove the sun rises? We all know this intuitively, but de Valin has the advantage of decades of observation. The most sublime recognized plot in Vosne-Romanée, and perhaps all of Burgundy, is the one that DRC takes its name from, Romanée Conti. And when I ask him what makes a great spot, he cites that one. Out of all of them, it deals with the weather conditions the best. In the end, what makes a great terroir is the mixture of all the elements together, where you have to do the least, where the vines are at peace and not in conflict. There are some undeniable truths to certain places, no matter what science says on the surface. It is entirely possible that with two adjacent pieces of land farmed using the exact same practices, one of them will prove better than the other. Why? It's complicated, but each place has a unique microclimate drawn from the hyperlocal factors of wind and weather, as well as minute differences in an area's propensity to frost, hail, and humidity. And some places just seem blessed. Terroir is a lot of things other than soil, but it is the soil that gives the vine a fighting chance. So, what are the best soils? It's not easy to categorize. Often, scientists get it wrong. Take a situation a few years back when a friend of mine, Andy Brennan, wanted to make cider in New York's Catskills. He found his preferred spot, but the folks at Cornell told him that shale was terrible for apples. He almost believed them until he realized his location was crawling with wild fruit and had a centuries-long apple heritage. What were those agriculturists thinking? He bought the place, and the cider continued. His Aaron Burr cider is tops. A great farmer has intuition and uses it, no matter what the scientists say. Most sites have their charms, provided you plant wisely to their specifics. Whether limestone, basalt, or schist, as de Valin says, a great terroir is not too little and not too much. It is the soil that helps the vine through the other elements. One can say the same thing about a human life. To de Valin, a great soil is part of the total picture. It is at best a place to grow that is not prone to difficulties, where one does not need to irrigate, and where one can do as little as possible to nurture grapes. It is a spot protected from warm winds if the land is in a hot zone, or protected from cold winds in a cold climate. The best soils are in places where nature is most in balance. The right kind of farming. Grapes are sensitive on one hand and sturdy on the other. The saying goes that you need to plant them where nothing else grows. That makes sense because the grapevine can grow on the tops of volcanoes, on rock or ash, or in sand. Since they are so resilient, why give them the same soil in which you can grow corn? It's the concept of no pain, no gain. Make life too easy for them and you'll end up with a dumb fruit, but make them struggle to go deep into the ground in search of a drink in soil that is poor? Now you're talking. But civilization likes things easy, so in comes unnecessary irrigation, bad for the environment and fine wine alike. In come the earth-moving machines to flatten the land. In comes chemically enhanced farming. Out goes quality. Almost all of the winemakers in this book make the point repeatedly that topsoil can be trumped by the farming. Mistreat great topsoil, and you'll get crappy wine. Treat dubious land beautifully and thoughtfully, and be prepared for a good surprise. Pierre Breton, at this point a legendary winemaker with his wife Catherine of Bourgaille in the Loire, says that if one thinks soil affects the taste of the grape and the acidity, it is only because when you work without chemicals in the vineyard, you bring the rich humus, which creates more microbiological life, to the soil. His point is that if the roots stay superficial as they do with ultra-modern methods, you get superficial tastes. In listing different producers throughout this audiobook, I have included their farming philosophy and whether or not they are certified. So, what are the options to working the topsoil? Conventional. This is a pleasant way of saying the farmer uses herbicides and pesticides. They may or may not plow, but probably not. No one who farms this way is in this book. If there's one polemic in this gentle book, it is this. Chemically intense farming and additive winemaking is totally against our philosophy and occludes the place where the vine is grown. Sustainable. Okay, so this one is like being a little bit pregnant, but there are all variations of sustainable. The French call it l'outre raisonné, which is farming by common sense. Basically, it means we reserve the right to spray when we need to spray. Some people never pull the trigger. Some spray all the time. So how do you know if the farming is real? Well, that's the problem. Everyone lies. It's sad, but true. So you have to rely on people like Pascaline and me, who visit a lot and ask the hard questions. Organic. In this approach, the farmer says ixnay to all synthetic chemical herbicides and pesticides, but does treat for disease using organic preparations. Back in the 70s, the organic farmers were made fun of as hippies who made ugly-looking vegetables. Today, this more than conscientious approach is spreading like crazy. We are now in the era of industrial organic, which is at least better than no organic. Biodynamic. Developed by the philosopher Rudolf Steiner, 1861 to 1925, this practice borrows pages from the ancients and takes a spiritual and homeopathic attitude toward farming. In biodynamic farming, you pace your practices to nature's rhythms. You work to understand the art of transformation through natural processes like fermentation, maybe by burying cow dung to turn it into pure and potent compost. Common practices include vineyard treatments that are organized according to the season, locations of the constellations, and the phases of the moon. The object is to heal, not harm. It is proactive rather than reactive. Its scope in farming is far greater than just the physical dirt and vine. This farming is based on 9 treatments that are of animal, vegetable, or mineral origins, sprayed in homeopathic doses. They seem to really work, although the ingredients raise snickers among the detractors. Dung, nettle, silica, and chamomile, for example, can be made into teas that are dynamized by intense swirling in water. This fosters a spiritual and hyper-observant bond between the farmer and the vine, and this in and of itself cannot be a bad thing. Natural farming. Whether you're a follower of permaculture or a follower of the cult of beloved Japanese farmer Masanobu Fukuoka, the idea here is the same. Do as little as possible. Use the ecosystem to do your work for you. Use beneficial plants to bring nutrients to the soil. Plant herbs like clover that will aerate and open up the soil instead of using invasive plowing. Take a natural approach to the vine, understanding that the vine is in balance with itself, that in the wild, the ecosystem heals all. For more on truly do-nothing farming, listen to the Hirotake Uoka profile in the granite section of Chapter 1. The right kind of winemaking. Most people are stunned when they learn that most wines out there are not 100% grape. The truth is that there are about 70 additives that are completely legal for winemaking. But it is my heartfelt belief that the only wines that truly manage to communicate place and vintage are those that start with at least organic viticulture and then have only grapes, with perhaps minimal sulfite addition. In other words, real wine generally has nothing added and nothing taken away. The alcoholic fermentation process is the same in all grapes. Yeast gobble up the sugar in the fruit and produce mostly alcohol plus carbon dioxide. There are a few ways of accomplishing this. The most common is to crush the grapes and let the yeast soak up the sugar. The other is to put the grapes, still whole, into a covered vessel, pump in CO2, and allow the fermentation to start inside the berry. This method of fermentation, called enzymatic, combined with various kinds of carbonic maceration, became identified with the Beaujolais region and now is often used to make easygoing, fragrant wines. All choices along the way impact the flavor and the color of wines. The most basic choices are: how will you farm? Conventional, organic, biodynamic, etc. Will you harvest the grapes by hand or use machine picking? How to sort the grapes? On a special sorting table, maybe even one that vibrates, in the field. De-stem grapes or keep them in bunches with stems intact. Make wine with whole bunches or just use whole berries. Crush by foot, vertical press, or bladder press. Remove grapes from their skins immediately or choose skin contact. Add the preservation sulfuric dioxide, SO2, and in what dose, or proceed with none. Wines come in all sorts of colors and textures. The color usually comes from the length of time the wine is fermented on the skins. White wine usually starts from white grapes like Chardonnay. However, white wine can also be made from pink grapes like the pink-skinned Pinot Gris or red grapes like Pinot Noir, as long as the flesh itself isn't red. Rosé is a blush-colored wine made from either a blend of red and white, especially in the Champagne region, or with just a few hours of skin contact on the grape. Amber-colored wines, sometimes called orange wines, meanwhile are made from white or pink grapes with quite a bit of skin contact, from hours to months. Then you have to decide what sort of container you want to put the wine into, whether it's glass, fiberglass, stainless steel, cement, clay, or wood. You'll have your pick of different sizes and shapes. Wood choices? There are plenty. Oak, cherry, acacia, chestnut, etc. If using an open-top fermenter, which is true for most reds, a crust of grape skins forms on the top of the fermenting wine, and you must push this cap of grapes under the liquid. This is done by machine, plunger, grid, or feet. You do this to keep the cap wet and safe from bacterial infection. This also extracts color and tannin, so you don't actually want to do it too much. Once fermentation naturally starts, it can take a couple of days or months to finish. As the mixture ferments, it gives off carbon dioxide. When alcoholic fermentation is finished, even if there's some sugar left over, the juice has been transformed into wine. It might have even gone through a secondary process called malolactic fermentation. That is when bacteria turn the harsher malic acid inside the grapes into softer lactic acid. This rounds the wine and naturally stabilizes it, and is far more common in red wines than white. You may or may not change the vessel and leave the wine there until it tastes ready. In making red wine or amber wine, once fermentation is finished, or when the color and extraction desired is achieved, it is time to press the wine off from the skins. The next decision is whether to remove the dead yeast cells or not. This might sound weird, but the leftover yeasts create a kind of silt called lees that actually has a lot of beneficial properties. The decision to remove them is often made in pursuit of a very clean flavor, but when you do leave the yeast, this is called surlis aging. It is often used in Muscadet to give richness. When stirred, as is often done in Burgundy, the lees can impart a creamy, almost oaky flavor to the wine. This stirring is called bâtonnage. The lees give a certain protection to the wine as well, so it's quite useful when making wine without sulfur. Many natural winemakers choose to keep a wine on the lees. So, what are the different ways to make wine? Conventional allows any and all of that. Winemakers are also allowed to use extreme machinery such as reverse osmosis, dialysis, or thermovinification, all of which affect and homogenize the final product. The upper limit of total SO2 allowed in wine in the U.S. is 350 ppm, parts per million. In the EU, it is 160 ppm for red wines and 210 ppm for dry white or rosé wines. Certified organic wine. All additives labeled organic are allowed. All processes are allowed. In the United States, no SO2 addition is allowed. In the EU, there are various laws governing organic wines. For For SO2 addition, the maximum for reds is 100 ppm, and for dry whites and rosés, it is 150 ppm. Certified biodynamic. This certification is not governmental, but provided by private associations such as Demeter. In the United States, Demeter allows 100 ppm SO2 addition. Some additives might be allowed, including added yeast, by petition. Biodynamic wines from Europe adhere to stricter rules. The maximum for reds is 70 ppm, and for dry whites and rosés, it is 90 ppm. Natural wine. There are no official laws governing this method, but it is presumed that it includes natural farming and a winemaking philosophy of nothing added or taken away, except maybe up to 20 ppm of SO2. Many natural winemakers choose volcanic sulfur instead of the petrochemical derivative sulfite, which is the norm. What's the deal with SO2? Sulfur dioxide, SO2, from volcanic or petrochemical origin, is commonly used as an additive in winemaking for its function as an antibacterial and antioxidant. Its use is ancient, dating back to the Romans burning sulfur dioxide inside of amphoras to sanitize them. With the modern age, SO2 was used in the process of winemaking for further control. A certain amount of SO2 is naturally produced as a byproduct of fermentation, but because it's an allergen, although other additives like tannin are probably worse, the bottle must carry a cautionary label if a wine has more than 10 ppm. Natural winemakers believe that the harm done to the wine, it binds it up, and they believe it contributes to hangovers, is worth avoiding. So, in desiring to deliver the most expressive and healthy wine possible, avoid SO2, except in minute amounts. Can you really taste dirt? How many times have I tasted with a winemaker who swears that the flint aroma in the wine comes from the silex in the soil, or perhaps declares that the ginger quality in a Meursault comes from the soil's limestone? I've lost count. It is nearly impossible to link up specific soils to tastes. If we claimed that was possible, Pascaline and I would be Twitter-shamed by the wine community so fast it would be a social media wildfire, and they would be right. It just ain't possible. However, there are a few benchmarks, and you can train your palate to look for them. Soil has an impact on the delivery and quality of acids and tannins. We can't overstate enough that weather and farming choices, as well as technique in the winery, have huge impacts as well. For example, a hot, sunny year brings higher alcohol and what is referred to as a solar wine. Wood aging can bring out the flavor of tannins. Using whole bunches of grapes adds a certain spiciness. So why all of this emphasis, a whole book, on soil if we can't give you a direct correlation? Because looking for the clues from the soil, even if you don't find them, heightens your tasting sensitivity and increases enjoyment. And more than anything, it brings you, as a drinker and wine lover, back to where the root of your passion resides, in the soil. It's just like how knowing music theory boosts your emotional response to a Beethoven sonata higher than you thought possible. To listen to where a wine comes from, pay attention to acidity, saltiness, and tannins, the basis for its texture and structure. The aromatics are interesting, but not as important, as they are constantly changing. Wine pros talk about vertical and horizontal structure. These give shape to a wine. Different wines hit the mouth in a variety of ways. Some give you a very long finish, meaning the taste goes on for a long time. Some seem to wash over in your mouth, and you might feel it across your tongue from left to right. That is horizontal. Wine pros also talk of a wine's acid structure. While that sounds a bit complicated, questions of acid structure are all about where the zing hits you in your mouth, on the top, near the tip of the tongue, in the back of your mouth, toward the throat. Another characteristic pros talk of is tannic structure. This is about the raspiness, much like the tannins in tea or coffee. They can come from non-wine ingredients, such as wood, but in a natural wine, tannins come from the grape skins, stems, and seeds. The tannins can be harsh and green or grippy, dry, wet, fat, or even chalky. Sometimes I use the word needle-like because they feel like a narrow line drawn through the wine. Sometimes the sensation is just a mouthful of broad tannin that goes all over the place. Not to get too new-agey about it, but take a breath and take a moment to notice it all, from the beginning, middle, and end of a sip of wine. Another term wine pros yammer on about is dry extract. You can visualize this somewhat off-putting term this way. Take a drink of filtered water, then drink a bit of highly mineral-laden bottled spring water. You'll taste the difference. You'll feel a touch of celery salt, something rusty or coppery, some briny characteristics, some grit. Now try a glass of Muscadet, the elixir-like wine from the Western Loire. You should pick up the same sensations and aromatics as the mineral water. To further visualize what we mean by dry extract, leave a couple of drops of wine in your glass on the counter of your kitchen overnight and look at the bottom of the glass the day after. There should be a white film left behind after the wine has evaporated. It seems to be an extract of the wine itself. Is it grainy to the touch? Is it salty to the taste? Think back to the mineral water, to the Muscadet. That's it. All of these characteristics might be able to give you clues to a wine's native soil. Try to be aware of them before you just settle into drinking, as they might help you to connect the dots later on. It will be easier for you to taste the difference in white wines, as they are the most transparent. So, in your tastings, try to go in the order of white, rosé, sparkling, amber, perhaps, red, and then finally, sweet. AOP, AOC, what do they mean? Most countries have ways of certifying wine districts in their wines, but the French formalized the concept in 1936. This was the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, or AOC. This system, which is now called AOP, was developed in order to inform the public what lands are considered better or classier than the others, calling attention to the specific characteristics of that place and that wine. This started as an attempt to control fraud and ensure what was claimed to be in the bottle really was in the bottle. It became the industry standard in Europe, and other countries followed suit. The Italians have a DOCG, which stands for Denominazione di Origine Controllata e Garantita, and is the most exalted, followed by a DOC. The Spanish have their DO system with DOC, Denominación de Origen Calificada, at the top. In Portugal, there is a DOC-DOP. The Greeks have the PDO, previously called OPAP and OPE. In the New World, the Americans have their AVA, American Viticultural Areas, of which Napa Valley is one, as its subset, Oakville AVA. But unlike the laws of Europe, there are no laws governing how to make the wine, what grape varieties are allowed, where the vine should be planted, or what kind of wines are allowed to be made from the specific region. This is partially thanks to the New World notion that all grapes can grow anywhere, but in the end, the category is more about political, administrative, and financial interests than any extraordinary regional or soil qualities. An appellation can be a large region, such as the Côte d'Aron, or a micro one, such as Cornas or Saint-Joseph. It can denote one particular vineyard with special qualities, such as Chateau Gruyère, or it can even be a kind of wine, such as Clairette de Die, which is an as-yet-not-wildly-popular Rhone sparkler. Those in charge of the regulations outline the rules with a peer group of producers for each individual region, determining what was allowed to grow, where it was allowed to grow, and how large the yields could be, such as lower yields are associated with higher quality. In some areas, such as Bondol in France, Rioja in Spain, and Barolo in Italy, there are even laws about how long a wine must spend aging in wood, tank, or in the bottle. Because of the EU, what was previously known as an AOC has been changed to AOP, meaning a protected appellation which stretches across EU borders. As of 2016, it is still confusing, but hopefully will be slowly accepted over the coming years. Meanwhile, there is dissent in France, the country from which all of this regulation originally sprouted. Over the past 20 years, the INAO, the board that governs the appellation rules, has been under attack. Some believe that what had started as a protection has now become a danger. The association has gone into the business of legislating not just what and how to grow, but how a wine should taste, based on preconceived notions of what is popular in the market, rather than respecting local traditions and subscribing to the well-tested attitude of vive la différence. It's rather dangerous to think of wines that are sound and yummy, yet outside the box is deviant. This could open the gate to much manipulation in the winery. All winemakers are motivated by some idea of commerce. Is a grape that is low-yielding and highly acidic, one that is not for everyone, really a grape that should be allowed? This kind of attitude has allowed situations like that of Romain Rattin, booted out from everywhere in the Loire except one little tiny village, Cours-Cheverny. But even more disturbing is the belief that the organization has elevated commercial wines over truly artisanal ones. Often, it has rewarded commercial and cookie-cutter wines but shunned wines of personality. This has led to a defection of some very fine producers who've chosen a lesser wine label, such as Vin de France or Vin de Pays or Vino di Tavola, table wine, for freedom. The trouble with these labels is that it is forbidden to print the exact location where the wine comes from, and to me, that's almost the most important detail when I make my decision about what wine to buy. Place matters. Period. How to taste wine. First, you'll need a glass. Forget the paper cup. It really is better in a glass. I prefer a glass with a very thin rim, and I don't care about the bowl. It just needs to be big enough for the wine to breathe. Please note, however, you should avoid very wide-mouth glasses, like the champagne coupe, as too many of the aromatics will be lost. Then, you want to drink. Very early on, one learns manners when it comes to food, how we should eat with a fork and a knife or keep our mouths closed when chewing. But are we typically taught how to enjoy wine? Nah, just drink. But then there are those times someone shoves a glass in your hand and says the dreaded word, guess. So in that case, what do? You look, swirl, sniff, sip, swallow, and, like a detective, look for clues. Clues are everywhere. Here's the way Pascaline and I handle it. Give it a quick first sniff. Certain aromas disappear very fast, especially if you frantically swirl what's in your glass. These are the lightest, most delicate whiffs. They whisper to you about the wine's nuances, leaves, flowers, fruits. Grab them before they vanish and never come back. Look for clarity. Is it cloudy? That could mean the wine was not filtered or fined. These are processes, chemical and physical, that can polish a wine and remove floating particles. But that doesn't mean that a wine that eschews these methods is always foggy. Take, for example, the Georgians, who make their wine in buried amphoras and leave it untouched for up to 8 months, after which it goes into the bottle absolutely clear. So just look, notice, and don't judge. Look at the color. White, red, rosé, amber. Look carefully from the core to the rim. Generally, white wines get deeper in color with age, while red wines get lighter. Young wines have a green or silver hue. Young reds, a pink-purple one. Amber-colored, it could be old and poorly stored, or it is a lovely wine from white grapes with some skin contact during the aging or fermenting process. Look at its texture. Give the wine a swirl. Look at the way it runs down the side of the glass. Those are called legs. Thick drips correspond to higher alcohol content. When they cling to the glass, you can pick up clues to the wine's origins and the vintage. A thinner wine should come from a cool vintage or climate and viscosity from warmer ones. Depending on how syrupy, the wine could be rich and sweet. Not much grip on that glass? Then it might be a cool climate wine. No legs at all? Well, then your glass is too clean. Try again. Now, is there crud floating in it? Don't worry, that's harmless. The wine could be old and that's sediment. Some people insist that drinking it keeps you healthy. If the gunk looks like crystallized sugar, these are called tartrates. The wine develops them if not filtered and if it has been kept cool. Smell for problems. Some people think anything out of the ordinary is a flaw, but truly, sometimes, all a wine needs is time. Here's what is going on. Is the wine corked, meaning does it smell like a musty cellar or a long-dead animal? It could be because the winery or the cork was contaminated with a compound called TCA, 2,4-6-trichloranazole. This is not a good thing. Or does it smell like a small closet stuffed with live sheep? We might have a problem with a strain of yeast called Brettanomyces. A little bit is not so bad, but a whole flock is an issue. Does it taste like pure and sharp vinegar, enough that it hurts your nose? In this case, there are severe problems with acetic bacteria. In other words, the wine is turned to vinegar. A little scent of nail polish remover, that's called volatile acidity, and as long as the wine tastes agreeable and is in balance, it is not a problem. Smell for pleasure. Look for fruit and or savory aromas, and have a good time with your nose in that glass. Not all wines have strong aromas of fruit like grapefruit or mango or elements that came out of a perfumer's suitcase, so open up your mind as well as your nasal passages. If the fruit is way too vivid and sterile, the wine's fermentation might have been kicked off by yeast instead of relying on the natural stuff. Or it was made with extreme temperature control or in a stainless steel container. If the white wine is savory, it could have been raised in concrete or clay pots of some kind. Can you smell the vessel it was made in? These aromas may include vanillin, cherry vanilla, burnt toast. When the aromas and flavors keep on coming at you, then you know you have a complex wine in your glass. Smell for serving it to your guests. If you're having a dinner party, you need to open up the wines to figure out if you need to decant them. So, take a smell. Notes of boys' locker room, rubber, or struck matches? That means the wine is probably reduced, meaning it's been kept without oxygen and needs to breathe. Certain grapes, like Syrah, are prone to it. Certain winemaking practices or closures, such as screw cap closures, foster it. What about little bubbles in a still wine? That's fine. Some winemakers who make wine without the preservative sulfur trap the CO2 during fermentation in order to give the wine protection. It displaces oxygen, which degrades the wine. But if it's more than a little stinky and the wine is supposed to be a still wine, plunk the wine into a decanter or a pitcher. Many wines need a bit of this oxygenation to open up, thus the real reason for serving wine from a decanter instead of the bottle. Taste. Now you get to confirm your suspicions or confound them. Is the wine dry or sweet? Fruity or savory? Alcoholic or gentle? Old or young? Notice the wine structure, what some call its bones. When tasters use words to describe what they like, such as big, rich, tannic, light, sparkly, and fresh, they are talking about that skeleton. Some wines have no bones. They are sloppy, flabby, and have no point of view. At the other end of the spectrum, some are like a slash or a punch, and some are well-mannered, with a distinct beginning, middle, and end. Ask yourself, is the wine flabby? Does it have a brightness? Does it burn with alcohol? That might mean a high acid red with some grippy tannins that probably hails from a northern climate. That exuberant, rich white with a pear skin, bitter almond, tannic quality is probably a thick skin white from hot summer region. Spit. I always thought I'd never do this in public. The first time I was in a room with 100 Zinfandels to taste, I knew I had no choice. To taste a wine when spitting is involved. You look at a wine, draw it in, aerate it a bit as if you're slurping soup, bring back a little in your mouth, feeling the roughness from the tannins, or the sweetness, or the bitterness. You'll also be able to smell additional aromas through something called retronasal smell, which uses the back door to your nasal passage. Then, spit it out in as beautiful a spit as you can manage. Even if I don't have 99 more to go, tasting a wine this way helps me focus on the wine's component parts. Drink. Any way you like. After all, this is the point. Some people, like Pascaline, can taste wines and zero in on the vintage, the grape variety, place of origin, and sometimes even the winemaker. Some people, like Raj Parr, a sommelier and winemaker, can damn near get the kind of soils the vine grows in. This is rare and extremely difficult. But the most important thing you're looking for is whether or not you like it. And if you like it, you can start to bring your tasting up to the next step, considering how you can serve the wine, what to pair it with, and how long you can keep it for. That is where you start and finish. The rest is for the professionals and for party tricks. In 2016, I was asked to chair an award for naturally made wines at the Vin Italy Wine Fair. I brought Pasqualine along to be one of my five judges. Most awards are given on points, with a certain amount of points given for color, aroma, clarity, and taste. But I presented my own criteria to the judges, and they worked very well indeed. Liveliness. At first sip, is there a lift in the mouth? This could be related to a nice acidity. Evolution in the glass. The wine is not locked into place, but might reveal something new with every sip. Balance. There is the sense that all is well in the glass. The elements, even those that could be thought of as flaws in conventional wine, such as Brettanomyces, volatility, and even some mousse or reduction, are all in harmony. Drinkability. You would like to drink the wine. This gives pleasure. Emotional impact. Can a wine make you feel? Of course it can. It can make you recoil in horror. On the other hand, a wine can make you smile, laugh, and feel intrigue and excitement. Even if there is a negative reaction initially, the first impression of the wine can be improved by it having any number of the other qualities. Savory quality. A wine can be pure fruit juice and be pretty, but it should also have an element of savoriness, evoking dried herbs, leaves, forest, pot, fresh hay, leather shoelaces, olive, Earl Grey tea, and so on. These flavors can often elevate a wine to greatness. Transparency. Is the wine a block? Is it impenetrable, or can you see through it? Can you tell its details, something about the way it's made? Does it seem honest to you? Can you tell the vintage detail? Can you hazard a guess as to whether it was made in a warm or cold year? Sense of place. Finally, there's that terrific, elusive quality. Can you tell where you are in the world when you sip it, even if you are wrong? Does the wine take you somewhere? In my book, if you have any six of these, then you've got an award winner in your glass.